Alors, bienvenue à la deuxième journée du forum du réseau de la Commission populaire « Quelle sécurité, notre sécurité ». Mon nom est Tatiana Gomez et je vais animer la discussion ce matin. So, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the second day of the People's Commission's Network Forum, Whose Security, Our Security. My name is Tatiana Gomez and I'm going to facilitate today's discussion. Alors, pour ceux qui auront besoin de traduction vers du français, de l'anglais vers le français. So, those who will need translation from English, from French towards English. Those who need translation to French, there's going to be, no. Those who need translation towards English, that gentleman over there is going to be doing the translation. It's going to be whisper translation. Alors, pour ceux qui auront besoin de traduction vers le français, c'est Fernand qui fera la traduction. Alors, ce sera la traduction chuchotée.
Il est où, Fernand?
Fernand. Alors, avant de débuter la discussion, quelques points logistiques. Nous avons des médias ici aujourd'hui, mais c'est seulement des médias communautaires que nous avons invités. Il y aura des photos qui seront prises, mais si vous n'êtes pas confortable d'apparaître dans des photos ou dans des vidéos, s'il vous plaît, communiquez avec un des organisateurs ou organisatrices, dont Mary. Vous pouvez parler avec elle ou Marie-Ève Lamy, qui est juste au centre de la salle. Les panels aujourd'hui seront diffusés sur rabble.ca, qui est un réseau communautaire. Et puis, chaque panel sera suivi par des ateliers qui auront lieu cet après-midi. Et puis, après la discussion d'aujourd'hui, de ce matin, il y aura un lunch qui sera servi gratuitement. Et puis, demain soir, à la clôture du forum, il y aura un souper de solidarité avec Mohamed Arkat. Aussi, si vous avez besoin d'un service de garde, le service de garde est disponible juste à l'intérieur de la salle. Alors, le panel d'aujourd'hui s'intitule « Qui a besoin du SCRS? » Le réseau de la Commission populaire mène une campagne depuis quelques mois déjà, presque un an, sur la non-collaboration avec le SCRS. Alors, le CRS a le mandat de protéger la sécurité nationale contre les menaces étrangères, mais aussi le rôle important de contenir la dissidence et la dissidence et l'existence des mouvements sociaux à l'intérieur du Canada. Donc, le but de la discussion aujourd'hui, c'est de mettre en question le rôle et l'existence même d'une organisation comme le SCRS. Alors, nous avons aujourd'hui 4 invités qui discuteront. On va commencer par Gary Kingsman, qui sera suivi par Marie-Ève Sauvé. Par la suite, Clifton Nicolas donnera son point de vue et on fermera la discussion avec Yavar Hamid. Je vais inviter Gary Kingsman à discuter. Gary Kingsman va donner un peu le contexte historique du SCRS et le développement et l'existence de cette organisation. Alors, Gary Kingsman est co-auteur de The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation, et il est aussi éditeur de Who's National Security, ainsi que de Sociology for Changing the World. Il est un militant auprès des luttes de libération queer et anticapitaliste depuis longtemps. Il est membre de Sudbury Against War and Occupation et le Palestine Solidarity Group. De plus, il enseigne la sociologie à l'Université Laurentienne. Alors, j'invite Gary à prendre la parole.
trying to get there without ripping any wires out of the floor. Good morning. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we're all on Mohawk territory, and the area where I live in Sudbury belongs to the Atikamishing Anishinaabeg people. I think it's really important for us in terms of any discussion of national security to start off with the recognition that from the very beginning of the Canadian colonial settler state project, that Indigenous people have been identified as a risk to the national security of that colonial settler project. I've got some PowerPoint slides here that hopefully you can see. It has a red background, so maybe you can't see it as effectively as I would like. I'm going to be drawing on material from the two books that are actually on the cover there, the covers of those books. One is an edited collection called... Oh, not on? Okay. I could probably be loud enough without it, but I think it's being recorded. So the two books that I'm going to be drawing on in terms of the talk that I'm giving today is Whose National Security, which came out of a conference we held at Laurentian University and was published as a book later on, and The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation, which I co-authored with Patrizia Gentile. Now, if we're trying to understand where CSIS came from and what CSIS is about, we really need to understand its history. CSIS continues in very profound ways the national security wars against the unions, against the left, against the Quebec sovereignty movement, against women's groups, against immigrants, anti-war activists, red and black power activists, student activists, lesbians and gay men, and many others that originated in the campaigns of the RCMP. Those campaigns continue within the work of CSIS. This is based on the notion of national security, the concept of national security, the ideological practice of national security, which is based on identifying certain groups of people as being national security risks or enemies of the state, and thereby expelling them from the fabric of the nation. Once people are successfully identified as a national security risk, and Mona yesterday, in terms of describing what had happened to Japanese Canadians, gave us an excellent illustration of this. Once they are successfully able to be constructed as risk to national security, they lose all of their democratic and human rights and are basically cut out of the fabric of the nation and the nation state. What I want to argue is that national security is in and of itself an ideological practice. It is always about excluding some groups of people from the fabric of the nation, denying them their rights, while including some other people at the center of the nation. National security is a relational social process based on the exclusion of some people and the inclusion of only certain groups of people at the center of society. Next slide. This is just an image of security surveillance. The major aspect of my historical sociological research has been on the national security campaigns against queers. From 1958 on, lesbians and gay men per se were identified as a risk to Canadian national security because we supposedly suffered from a character weakness that made us vulnerable to blackmail from evil Soviet agents. I hope you're getting some of the sarcasm here. There's no evidence that any individual within the Canadian state ever gave any information to these evil Soviet agents on this basis. And of the people we talked to many people who were interrogated and purged. The only people who ever blackmailed them was the RCMP themselves, trying to get them to give the names of other lesbians and gay men. But during these campaigns, thousands of people lost their jobs, their careers were destroyed. There's all sorts of other aspects of the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men that if I can do a brief plug, I would encourage you to purchase copies of the Canadian War on Queers that is out there in the lobby. None of these people have ever been compensated or apologized to by the Canadian state, except for Michelle Douglas and a few other people who waged successful campaigns in the early 1990s to get rid of the purge campaigns in the military. This image here is of a 1976 demonstration on Parliament Hill, in which you, which was part of a lesbian and gay rights conference. You see uniformed RCMP officers doing surveillance work. There was obviously lots of undercover agents involved, including infiltrators of the lesbian and gay movements who gave reports to the RCMP. What begins to happen by the mid-1970s in relationship to the campaigns against lesbians and gay men, but in other areas as well, is that you see growing resistance. to these national security campaigns. This is actually a demonstration that occurred in June of 1976 against the social cleansing of queer people that preceded the 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal. You're probably aware, in terms of the Olympics that just have taken place in Vancouver and Whistler, that there was a major social cleansing campaign of poor and homeless people. That happened at the same time as this as well in the 70s, but there was also a particular purge campaign, closing down cleansing campaign directed against lesbians and gay men. At one point in time, all lesbian and gay establishments in Montreal were closed down by police actions, both by the RCMP and also by the sexual police more generally. This demonstration signaled a major resistance to that, and there was a turning around of the situation. And that's part of what I want to signal. If we look at the history of national security campaigns in Canada, the history of national security policing, we also discover really important histories of resistance. So in the 1970s, there are growing campaigns against the RCMP on numerous fronts, including the lesbian and gay movements, including the Quebec independence movement, including the left. There are a series of RCMP dirty tricks, as they were often referred to at the time, that Marc-André detailed last night, that were directed against the left and the Quebec independence movement, including the planting of bombs, including the stealing of subscription lists, including a barn burning, many other activities. I'm not going to go into that here. But there were major problems that the RCMP was encountering. People were finding out what they were doing. It was becoming a public issue. People were organizing around it. And eventually, the mainstream media was forced to pay attention to this. The RCMP, as a result, lost credibility, it lost legitimacy. This produced a certain type of legitimacy crisis for the state because they required a national security police force, but the one that they had lost basically most of its credibility and most of its legitimacy. The response of the Canadian state, as to many other crises, was to set up a commission of inquiry, right, to try to investigate what the problem was. The McDonald Commission was set up and worked from 1977 until 1981. It was set up in response to this crisis of legitimacy, but also in response to the establishment by the Parti Québécois provincial government in Quebec of the Keeble Commission, which began to make visible some of the dirty tricks that had been engaged in against the left and the independence movement in Quebec. So that was starting to get more visible, more public. The response of the federal government was, first of all, to try to shut down the Keeble Commission, try to restrict what it could do, and eventually they formed their own commission, the McDonald Commission. This is obviously a standard response to a legitimacy crisis. They gave the McDonald Commission a very limited terms of reference. It was directed to produce knowledge for the state, to fix the problem, but to also make security policing more effective without raising any fundamental challenges to national security itself. So in the work of the McDonald Commission, it holds the ideology of national security in place while trying to make the security police more effective, while arguing on the one hand for the rule of law, which sometimes can be useful for us in terms of arguing for restraints of some of the most repressive aspects of police activity. But we also have to remember that the rule of law is also what, in a normal, everyday sense, allows for oppression and exploitation to take place in our society. So the rule of law is basically not on our side, even though we have to use it every once in a while. The McDonald Commission centrally argued for a new civilian security service to replace the RCMP. And this is what laid the basis for state moves to remove security work from the RCMP. So there began to be a bunch of struggles over what was going to go on. The state did not really respond to the McDonald Commission in general. It simply took this proposal for a new civilian security service and tried to act on it. It really needed a new national security police force, and it tried to enforce one on the Canadian people. It first of all proposed Bill 157. Immediately, there was an alliance of anti-war activists, feminists, First Nations groups, gay and lesbian activists, and civil liberties groups that opposed Bill 157, and we were successful. It's important to celebrate our victories in killing that bill. But quickly, the federal government moved with a few cosmetic changes. It didn't change anything substantially in Bill 157 and proposed a new bill, C-9. Which they then rushed through, which was passed and led to the enactment of CSIS. The main points of opposition that people made are really important to remember. Basically, this legislation made it legal for CSIS operatives to engage in illegal activities. It made that absolutely clear. that CSIS operatives could engage in illegal activities and they were not breaking the law. It gave a very, very broad-ranging definition of subversion to what CSIS could operate in relationship to. Maybe we can get into that in the discussion period, but basically what the notion of subversion does is it criminalizes and mandates surveillance against completely legal activity, which the state believes might down the road lead to illegal activity, right? So thoughts can get criminalized under national security. Various different practices that don't explicitly break the law can get criminalized as national security risks because somewhere down the road they believe they might actually lead to criminal activity. The other aspect that was raised by activists was the lack of democratic accountability on the part of this new formation of CSIS. Ominously enough, in 1984, CSIS was formed, which is ominous in and of itself. The second thing that should give us some indication is that most of the initial employees of CSIS were former members of the RCMP Security Service. So in terms of the early history of CSIS, because some other people will be talking about later history, the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men continue by CSIS into the 1990s, and to this day, CSIS operatives can deny lesbians and gay men national security clearances if they are considered to be in the closet or have something to hide. There were major campaigns directed against the union movement, including the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, which Everett Hoogers documents in the Who's National Security book. They were directed against activists involved in direct action and civil disobedience. They were also directed and engaged in activities against people organizing in solidarity movements with people fighting in the Third World for national and social liberation. So, for instance, in the late 1980s in Canada, CSIS considered anyone who opposed U.S. policies in El Salvador to be a risk to Canadian national security. So you begin to see some of the ways in which this was deployed. The CSIS activities continued during the first Gulf War in 1991 in a major way, and they got quite extended. Zuhair Kashmiri has documented that. He has a chapter in the Who's National Security book. What he documented was a major targeting of Arab and Muslim-identified residents in Canada, a major form of racial and cultural profiling. People were put under surveillance. They had photos taken of them. There were interviews that were organized. CSIS called them interviews. Other people referred to them as interrogations of more than 500 individuals, probably a lot more than that. Those are just the reported number that took place during the time of the Gulf War. These people were asked questions about their friends, about acquaintances, about people they knew in the mosque, about politics in the countries where they may have come from. All sorts of questions were asked for them. Basically, this was the testing ground for many of the tactics that are now being used in the context of the so-called war on terror. Now, to try to draw some conclusions from looking at the history and the practice of CSIS, I think we have to realize that we absolutely need to abolish CSIS now. CSIS and national security in the context of the current wars on subversion, just think about what happened at the G20 last June in Toronto with the massive denial of democratic and civil rights, with anti-capitalist and global justice protesters basically expelled from the fabric of the Canadian nation, or look at what's going on in the context of the so-called war on terror, and we can see that national security and CSIS have been used systematically as a way of denying people their democratic and human rights. They have become, and they have always been, a threat to our security, a threat to people's security, a threat to popular security. They need to be abolished. Now, just in relationship to that, I should point out that in 1996, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers was actually successful in getting the Canadian Labour Congress to adopt a resolution calling for the abolition of CSIS. We need to return to these types of measures, and we need to expand them. So this was in 1996 that the Vancouver local of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers got the CLC's Human Rights Commission and then the executive of the CLC to endorse the following motion. I'm just reading part of it. This is their resolution. Therefore, be it resolved that the Canadian Labour Congress demand that CSIS be disbanded and all unionized CSIS workers be reassigned to other government departments and agencies. And be it further resolved that the federal government redirect the financial savings gained from disbanding CSIS towards investigating the income tax returns of corporations. Anyway, I think we would want to rewrite this resolution and make it somewhat different, but I think we have to look back at, on the past and how people have actually tried to wage campaigns for the abolition of CSIS. We clearly need to oppose national security. It's not just that there's some problems with the national security that CSIS has engaged in. There's a problem with national security itself. Instead, we need to talk about people security, popular security, security of our communities and of our social movements for social transformation. And hopefully this conference can begin to elaborate in more detail what that means more concretely and on the ground. So thank you very much. And hopefully I didn't produce too many problems with the translator by talking too fast.
Alors, Gary Kingsman vient tout juste de nous parler des origines historiques du SCRS, ainsi que de parler de plusieurs exemples de ciblage de certaines communautés. Marie-Ève Sauvé, qui est la prochaine personne qui va nous parler, va continuer dans cette approche. Elle va parler particulièrement du ciblage plus récent des militants, surtout les militants anticapitalistes et les militants en solidarité avec la Palestine ici à Montréal. Alors, Marie-Ève, elle est active dans Tadamon et dans la convergence des luttes anticapitalistes. Elle a été sujet de harcèlement par le SCRS avant les manifestations contre les Olympiques et la visite de George Bush à Montréal en 2009. Pendant le sommet du G20 à Toronto, cette année en juin, en juin 2010, elle a été arrêtée de façon préventive sous des accusations de complot à Toronto le matin du 26 juin, avant le début de la manifestation. Elle a passé plusieurs journées en prison et a été accusée de « weapons dangerous » avant que toutes les accusations aient été abandonnées après quelques mois. Donc, j'inviterai Marie-Ève Sauvé à prendre la parole. Bonjour.
C'est ça. Premièrement, je vais vous parler un peu de ma propre expérience avec le SCRS. Puis après ça, je vais vous parler plus en général de comment sont ciblés les militants, de quelle façon, puis aussi pourquoi, selon moi, on devrait appuyer l'attitude de non-collaboration avec le SCRS. C'est ça. Moi, ma propre expérience, c'est que j'ai pas eu de visite du SCRS chez moi. Mais comme ils font souvent, ils sont allés poser des questions sur moi où j'habitais avant à mon ancienne coloc, en demandant pour moi. Au début, on se disait, donc c'est niaiseux, c'est des services secrets, puis ils ne savent pas que je suis déménagée, mais dans le fond, probablement que c'était une façon d'avoir de l'information. Puis ça, c'était à la veille de la manifestation où on a lancé des souliers sur l'hôtel où George Bush allait parler. Puis juste quelques semaines avant qu'on organise les manifestations contre le passage de la flamme olympique. Puis c'est ça. Dans le fond, mon ancienne coloc était au courant que, dans le fond, si le SRS vient, on ferme la porte. Mais la personne qui est venue est rentrée et a fermé la porte derrière elle. Donc, elle n'a pas pu vraiment dire y fermer la porte d'en face parce que la madame était déjà rentrée. Puis c'est ça, elle a commencé à poser des questions sur moi, sur la violence, sur d'autres personnes qui ont été visitées. C'est ça. Donc, c'est comme ça que j'ai su que le SCRS posait des questions sur moi. Aussi, je suis membre de Tadamon, qui est un groupe de solidarité avec le Moyen-Orient, en particulier avec la Palestine. Puis moi, je n'ai pas eu de visite à propos de ça, mais plusieurs personnes du groupe en ont eu. Donc, ça a été quelque chose qu'on a dû dealer avec dans le groupe. Puis aussi, je vais vous donner un exemple. Je ne suis pas sûre à 100% que c'est le SCRS, mais ça ressemble à ça. Quand je me suis fait arrêter préventivement pendant le G20, le samedi matin, avant les manifestations, dans la rafle qui ont ramassé tout le monde pour les personnes qui sont accusées de complot, je pense que c'était 20, maintenant c'est 17, j'ai été arrêtée avec une personne qui était sous mandat. Puis quand on était au centre de détention, à chaque fois qu'on était interrogé par des policiers, c'était comme ils nous disaient, il y a un enregistrement là, c'est filmé, blablabla. Ils essayaient de faire comme toutes les procédures, mais aussi moi puis une autre personne avec qui j'ai été arrêtée, d'autres personnes probablement, on a été amenés dans une petite salle où ils nous disaient il n'y a rien enregistré, le monsieur chuchotait, c'était comme deux hommes dont un habillé comme en motard, puis ils nous ont dit qu'ils n'étaient pas de la police, qu'ils étaient comme au-dessus de la police, puis là ils se sont mis à poser des questions sur... sur qu'est-ce qui allait se passer après. Il nous racontait que dehors, tout le monde était en train de se faire battre puis massacrer, puis que là, c'était l'enfer, puis qu'il fallait qu'on donne des informations sur ce qui se passait après. Donc, si c'est pas le SRS, c'est dans la même famille. Donc, c'est ça. Il y a beaucoup de militants qui se font visiter par le SRS. Il y en a eu depuis des années. Dans le fond, depuis que moi je milite, il y avait eu une vague autour du Sommet des Amériques en 2001, mais il y en a eu une aussi maintenant, 2010-2011, il y a eu beaucoup de visites. Ça a commencé, c'est ça, à peu près au même moment que moi j'ai été visitée, là, au moment des Jeux du début des contestations contre les Jeux olympiques, puis aussi le G20, des choses comme ça. Pourquoi ils nous visitent? Ils donnent souvent l'excuse de la violence parce que, bon, ça paraît bien, puis ça, dans le fond, ils veulent que des gens donnent des informations sur des choses des activités qui pourraient blesser des gens, des attentats, des choses comme ça. Mais dans le fond, ce qu'ils veulent savoir, c'est n'importe quoi, ce qui peut, dans le fond, nuire à l'image du Canada, nuire à l'ordre. Pas seulement les choses de violence. Donc, ils veulent avoir des informations sur les actions, sur les liens entre les personnes, sur qui travaille sur quoi, sur quelle activité, même que ce soit légal ou paisible ou des choses comme ça. Aussi, si les personnes les écoutent parler, ils vont souvent partager des fausses informations ou essayer de diviser les gens, essayer de voir c'est quoi les liens entre les gens. Puis aussi, c'est ça, c'est sûr qu'une autre des raisons, c'est carrément d'intimider, parce que même si la personne ferme la porte au nez du SRS, ben c'est de l'intimidation envers les militants. Puis c'est ça, il y a plusieurs sujets sur lesquels le SRS veut récolter de l'information. C'est sûr qu'on ne sait pas souvent c'est quoi des sujets, parce que des fois les personnes ferment la porte, donc on ne sait pas sur quoi ils veulent poser des questions, mais on réussit quand même, des fois ils ont été écoutés assez longtemps pour pouvoir le dire, donc on sait qu'il y a beaucoup de personnes qui ont été visitées à propos des Olympiques et du G20, justement parce que ça, dans le fond, la dissidence contre ça, toute forme de dissidence contre ça, ça brise l'image du Canada à l'intérieur puis à l'extérieur. Aussi, les personnes qui appuient les luttes autochtones ou environnementales qui reçoivent des visites. Puis aussi, les militants, militantes pro-palestiniens. On sait que le gouvernement conservateur, il est vraiment pro-Israël, puis que c'est vraiment un sujet délicat, l'appui à la Palestine. Il y a un accord de sécurité entre le Canada et Israël, qui a été signé en 2011, mais il y en avait un autre avant, depuis 2008 à peu près, sur la sécurité entre les frontières Canada-Israël, même si, ben, il n'y a pas de frontières physiques, mais en tout cas. Puis c'est ça, donc il y a plusieurs groupes de solidarité avec la Palestine qui ont été visés, dont Adamon. Le genre d'intimidation qu'ils font chez les gens... Je ne peux pas vous donner des détails 100% parce que c'est des informations confidentielles, mais entre autres, c'est qu'ils vont sonner chez les gens ou sonner chez des anciens colocataires ou des amis des gens. Aussi, ils font du harcèlement au téléphone. Ça peut être aussi dans la rue. Ils vous suivent quand vous sortez de chez vous ou quand vous arrivez chez vous pour poser des questions. Ils visitent des amis, de la famille. Il y a des gens qui ont été visités au travail. Puis, souvent, il y a des personnes qui reçoivent juste une visite, mais il y a beaucoup de personnes qui reçoivent plusieurs visites, qui ont des visites à leurs amis. Le SRS va souvent chez eux, leur téléphone. Donc, il y a des personnes pour qui ça devient vraiment un enfer, puis c'est ça. Je vais vous parler de l'exemple de Tadamon, dont je fais partie. Il y a 4 personnes qui ont eu des visites, dont 2 personnes qui ont un statut précaire d'immigration. Puis une des personnes qui a eu vraiment beaucoup de visites envers ses amis qui ne sont pas des militants pour avoir n'importe quelle information. Dans le groupe, ça l'a fait beaucoup d'inquiétudes, entre autres parce qu'il y a beaucoup de personnes qui avaient un statut précaire, qui sont pas, qui n'ont pas la citoyenneté canadienne. Puis, c'est ça, on a dû, dans le fond, demander à la commission populaire de les rencontrer. Il y avait un avocat pour pouvoir poser des questions parce que, c'est ça, ça devenait un problème dans le groupe puis ça soulevait beaucoup d'inquiétudes. Il y a aussi un appartement avec beaucoup de monde qui habite dedans qui est souvent visé parce qu'il y a des personnes de là qui sont visées. Un autre exemple, je ne sais pas si ça serait arrivé, mais moi, je suis allée 2 fois en Palestine, puis la 2e fois, avant de rentrer sous condition, j'ai eu un long interrogatoire. Puis ils m'ont menacé de déportation, puis que si j'étais déportée, ils me donneraient au SCRS, puis que là, l'interrogatoire serait plus corsé, disons. Fait que, en tout cas, je ne sais pas si ça serait arrivé, mais c'est ça. C'est ça, avec tous les exemples que j'ai donnés, moi, je prône l'attitude de non-collaboration. Puis cette campagne-là, elle a vraiment bien marché chez les militants anticapitalistes pour plusieurs raisons. Je pense, bien, la plupart des personnes visitées ont la citoyenneté canadienne, donc c'est sûr que je pense que quelqu'un va parler au panel sur les visites des personnes qui n'ont pas la citoyenneté. C'est vraiment plus touché de pas répondre, de fermer la porte. Donc, quand c'est des personnes qui n'ont pas de problème de statut précaire, ben, c'est plus facile de fermer la porte. Aussi, souvent, les militants, ben, ce n'est pas notre première expérience avec la police, donc on est plus préparé à refuser de répondre. Il y a beaucoup de communication entre nous, là, surtout avec Internet. Donc, quand il y a une campagne, tout le monde le sait. Quand il y a des visites, tout le monde le sait. On est préparé. On sait que ça peut nous arriver. Puis aussi, il y a moins d'isolement que sur des personnes, disons, qui ne connaissent pas beaucoup de gens, qui ont des visites. Nous, entre nous, on se connaît puis on se parle. Donc, c'est plus facile de pouvoir résister dans ce temps-là. Politiquement, pourquoi ne pas collaborer? Dans le fond, souvent par curiosité, on serait tenté de... c'est les laisser rentrer pour écouter, pour savoir de quoi ils veulent nous parler, sur quoi ils veulent poser des questions. Mais je pense qu'on ne doit même pas les écouter, même si on voudrait savoir, parce que c'est des espions entraînés, ce n'est pas des débutants. Puis, c'est ça, les autres, ils aiment disséminer de la fausse information. Puis aussi, ils peuvent ramasser des informations sur des choses qui peuvent nous paraître anodines, des choses qui sont légales, mais... ça, c'est quand même du partage d'informations avec eux. Puis aussi, plus qu'on répond, plus qu'ils vont revenir. C'est ça. Aussi, comme je l'ai dit plus tôt, ils donnent souvent l'excuse de la violence, mais des activités légales ou paisibles, si c'est sur des sujets qui intéressent les SCRS, ben c'est des choses qui les intéressent de savoir. Puis, dans le fond, ils vont essayer de nous entortiller avec des... En posant des questions sur la violence, mais dans le fond, ils veulent savoir les activités que les gens font. Puis, si on leur parle, bien, ils vont savoir qui fait quoi, c'est quoi nos activités, c'est quoi les sujets sur lesquels on travaille, qui travaille avec qui connaît qui. Donc, eux, ça les aide dans leur travail, puis nous, on n'a aucun intérêt à les aider, dans le fond. Puis aussi, si on leur parle ou si on les écoute, ben ça les légitimise, puis ça les encourage. Puis aussi, ça va nuire aux personnes qui se font harceler ou qui se font, qui disent non, parce que dans le fond, c'est ça, faut qu'on dise non tous ensemble, sinon les personnes qui le font peuvent avoir des problèmes ou, c'est ça. On veut pas encourager le SCRS. On n'a pas d'avantage à leur parler, à part de paraître bien envers les agents à qui on répond, mais pourquoi on voudrait bien paraître envers eux? Il n'y a pas de raison. Puis, Puis c'est ça. Même si on se dit j'ai rien à cacher, ben oui, n'importe quoi pour eux peut être intéressant. Puis c'est ça. Ben comme je le disais en conclusion, c'est un choix politique de ne pas répondre au SCRS. Puis on doit appuyer la non-collaboration, puis partager, dans le fond, l'information avec les gens de fermer la porte au nez du SCRS. Puis, comme on veut, on refuse les interrogatoires par la police, ben c'est la même chose. C'est ça.
Merci, Marie-Ève. Alors, pour ceux qui sont arrivés un peu tard ce matin, il y a de la traduction vers le français qui est faite par Fernand, qui est juste en arrière. Fernand, ça c'est Fernand, si vous avez besoin de la traduction vers le français. If you're going to need translation towards English, English translation is available at the back with this gentleman, so you can just go see him. Alors, comme j'avais dit plus tôt ce matin, le but de la discussion aujourd'hui, c'est de questionner le rôle du SCRS et de mettre en question l'existence même d'une telle agence qui a comme rôle de justement de faire de la surveillance et de la répression à l'intérieur du Canada. Ainsi que d'autres mandats. Mais aujourd'hui, nous avons déjà entendu plusieurs exemples, dont les exemples présentés par Gary Kingsmin, surtout sur le ciblage des communautés gays et lesbiennes au Canada, ainsi que les exemples dont Marie-Ève a parlé, le ciblage des communautés militantes, surtout les anticapitalistes, et sont en solidarité avec la Palestine. Dans le même ordre d'idées, on va voir deux autres intervenants, dont Clifton Nicholas et Yavar Hamid, qui vont parler d'autres exemples. Le but de donner tous ces exemples, c'est justement de briser l'isolement, de voir que même si on vient de différentes communautés, on partage des expériences, on est ciblé par les mêmes agences de l'État, et de commencer à avoir une discussion à comment lutter contre un tel organisme et comment faire face au SCRS. Alors, je vais maintenant demander à Clifton Nicholas de prendre la parole. Clifton est un Mohawk de Kanasatake qui a été actif lors de la crise d'Oka de 1990 et qui demeure très actif au sein de la communauté de la résistance de celle-ci. Clifton est ainsi que d'autres membres de sa communauté ont été ciblés par le SCRS.
My name is Clifton. How do you all get, Nicholas? I'll speak in English and I'll accommodate you. So, even though you should learn my language, but that's another issue altogether. Our MC said, I was involved in the 1990 Oka crisis, which was 20 years ago. It was popped up 17, going on 18 at the time, and I didn't know what I was getting into, and drastically changed my point of view of the world and everything that goes on in this world. And there's no doubt about that. When we saw the whole brunt of the state come down on our community with jets, tanks, armored personnel carriers, machine guns, helicopters, nuclear submarines, especially the Americans, they didn't bring a nuclear sub through Ganawage at the height of the crisis. But it's after 1990 where things really got creepy. My experiences with CSIS and my community's experience of CSIS go back 20 plus years. But I'll just keep to the 20 years after 1990 because those are the experiences that I have firsthand knowledge of. I remember immediately following 1990, we had a lot of people coming into the community as infiltrators, disguising themselves as Native activists, as non-Native supporters, trying very hard to get into the community. I remember one individual in particular who we had caught, and we ransacked his vehicle and we ransacked his goods, and we found Canadian RCMP accreditations and different passes and recording devices and phone numbers and a whole slew of pictures. I mean, this was a reoccurring thing. Like my the first speaker had said, you know, like that, we are a national security threat, and I'm proud of being a national security threat. You know, I'm a national security threat by birthright. And, you know, we as Native people, we're counterproductive. We are, because we don't let you produce what you want to produce. The days of free-for-alls are done, for the most part. And I got to say that I'm proud that I took part in the movement during 1990 that lit a fire not only under the Native communities, but under the activist communities also. You know, that we're able to say that we refuse to allow things to happen. And by going out on a limb, by being in this kind of a forum, being involved, I put myself at personal risk all the time. And I've had issues with various operatives, I would say, from those organizations. And they tend to target, like I'm not, you know, but despite experiences, I'm far from perfect. But I'm a recovering addict. And during that period of time, I was targeted because I was in a point of weakness. But fortunately, I still know my right from wrong. You know, maybe a junkie, but I still know what I'm doing. You know, and I'm able to refuse and resist what they were trying to do at that time to me. You know, to manipulate you into a situation, isolate you from your family, isolate you from your friends, try to find ins into the communities that you associate with, the different activist communities, the different organizations within your own groups. You know, and there's a lot of creepy things that they do. I have one interesting example. Like I said, going out on a limb, because I'm very vocal. I always talk about our resistance in the community. I participate often. I don't just sit there. You know, I'm very proactive in my community. I try my best. I have a lot of friends who do a lot also, but they're not willing to speak. So I take this role as a person who speaks, and I've got to be clear, I don't represent Ganasadag. I represent Clifton Ariwagete from Ganasadag, who is involved with people who do things in the community. And it's really scary that I know that after 1990, there was a lot of people who were blackmailed, with whatever other way. And they tried blackmailing me at one point. I remember the SQ had a similar situation as you have. I'm supposed to be interrogated by the SQ for an action that was happening in the community. I got arrested. I ended up with people who were not even cops and refused to identify themselves, asking me all kinds of questions. And basically that happened for about 2 hours. It's not, like somebody said, it's not an interview, it's an interrogation, because you have no choice. You have to sit there and take try to not answer their questions. But, you know, they I know that they've gotten a couple of people. One person in my community who I will not mention, you know, they caught them in a weak point in their life. They're going through the divorce. They were struggling themselves with alcohol issues, trying to get clean, trying to stay straight, trying to get their lives back in order. And he did divulge some information at the time, which he didn't know any better. They threatened him. You know, I don't know how it works with the non-Native community, but in the Native community, there's so many different things that they will do to us to try and coerce us into giving them information. And they use these terror tactics against us. And I'm sure they do the same to you. I mean, you know, most of the people here have origins in being poor people. So they do terror tactics against poor people in general. It doesn't matter what color you are or what creed you are. You know, you're a target because of your socioeconomic status. That being said, I'm kind of rambling here, so excuse me. I'm just like I'm not really prepared like some of my panelists are, but. I take a stand. I say things. I know friends who are traditional people in Ganawag who also take stands and they say things, because I am a nationalist. You know, I'm a nationalist. You know, and I'm a Kanyokahaga sovereigntist. At the same, I'm an inclusionist, because you're all my brothers and sisters. I don't believe that we should separate. The spirit of my ancestors have always been inclusive. I mean, this country would not exist if it wasn't for a willingness to include. Because how can you say that I'll exclude people? Anyways, I'm rambling again. a friend of mine in Ganawaga, Tommy Deere, had a good example of a story of his experiences with CSIS, had been contacted a little over a year ago, and they were relentless with contacting him. So finally he decided, you know, I'll go meet them. And he met them in the city, and then he gathered some information from them that they had many paid operatives within Ganawaga, and they wanted to offer him the same opportunity. They offered him something like $10,000 to become an operative, to be an informant. From that meeting, he went right home and he wrote an article for the Eastern Door newspaper, detailed, and he had people take pictures while he went to meet them in Montreal. So he did a little bit of counter surveillance on them, and he published their pictures in the Eastern Door. He published their pictures and information, and everything that he did with them, he had it published. And that's what we have to do, expose them. You know, they called me just prior to the G20. I had done a conference in Toronto, and it creeped me out a bit, because when the woman called, she told me that, we heard what you had to say at the conference, which is like, I'm not really surprised, but at the same time, it's kind of a little shock too, that, you know, like, that, you know, Big Brother is watching me in that level. And they knew some of my conversations that I had in the hallways. And they asked me, like, what was going on with the G20, what was going on particularly with the indigenous issue. And at the time, during the summer of 2010, there was kind of a land dispute, a reoccurring land dispute again, in the same land as in 1990. And they wanted to know, like, what kind of a violent tactics we were going to use. I said, I've got nothing to say, and don't call here anymore. Fortunately, after 1990, one thing that did change, once we started weeding out some of these operatives that did come, the ones that we could find, because there are a lot of them that are more sneaky, that we couldn't find these people. But one thing that happened was we noticed that a lot of these strange people coming out of the woodwork stopped coming around because they were scared, which I've got to be very happy for, because they don't come knocking on my door. Because if we know, like, for people like me, if a CSIS operative knocks on my door, I'll make sure that all my friends and my brothers all know that there's a CSIS guy in the territory and he has to leave, you know, and he's going to have to try to leave, actually. So that's what we do back home, you know. It's the difference between living in the territory and living on the outside, is that, you know, living on the outside, you know, they have this certain, this fantasy of law and order and security from the police forces. But in my community, the police has always been the enemy. And it's been like that since I can remember. Never been any friends of ours. So when they come to my community, like they do all the time, which is unfortunate, but they do come with tanks, you know, because then they won't send these people knocking on my door. Because like I said, they want to go, and I remind them that they want to collect the pension if they come to Ganastaga. So we refuse. We expose. I tell that to all the other people in Native movements when I have a chance, when I go to British Columbia. I meet some of my friends, you know, I said, you got to be very vigilant. You always got to be on top of things. It's nice to have connections with different activist groups, but at the same time, you have to remain vigilant and always have your security as your number one concern. On that note, I'm not going to ramble on any longer. Nyawangkoa, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Merci, Clifton. Alors, maintenant, Yaver Hamid va poursuivre. Il va parler surtout du profilage des communautés arabes et musulmanes. Alors, Yaver Hamid est activement impliqué depuis le 11 septembre 2001 en donnant des conseils aux musulmans et aux arabes dans un contexte d'enquête du SCRS sur les enjeux de la sécurité nationale comme défenseur des droits humains face à un État sécuritaire de plus en plus dur. Il a représenté Abu Soufiane Abdelrazik dans ses démarches pour être rapatrié du Soudan après une rendition orchestrée par la RCRS. Il est présentement l'avocat de Mohamed Majoub dans son dossier de certificat de sécurité.
Good morning. Thank you, Tatiana. First of all, I want to say that I'm very privileged to be on this panel with some excellent speakers at an excellent event. I think this is very important. I want to echo one comment at the outset. a comment that Gary Kinsman reminded us of in terms of where we're situated at this in terms of this juncture, that we're informed by our history. And a concept that Gary talks about in his new book, The War on Queers, which has impacted me on some of my thinking on these topics, is that we live in the era of the historical present, constantly being informed by the resonances of history. And in that sense, what Clifton talked about, the struggles of others who have come before us, the lands on which we live, are a constant reminder to how the state, how the Canadian state has dealt with national security over time. I'm going to be speaking to you this morning based on a lot of my experience representing persons in the Muslims and Arab communities, particularly since September 11th, 2001, over the last 10 years, in the context of what we would know as the global war on terror. But really, I think that what we see in this context is symptomatic of broader strategies, broader phenomena in terms of marginalization of different communities. And I think that you'll see the linkages in terms of what I'm going to bring forward with some of the experiences that we've seen in Muslim and Arab communities with some of the other struggles which have been talked about this morning. At the outset, one thing I'll say, and it's a challenge to all of us here, is that there has been documentation, there has been writing, there has been resistance on what's been happening in Muslim and Arab communities with respect to racial profiling, particularly the role of CSIS, but there needs to be more. There needs to be much more, a real concerted body of writing, literature, and analysis, because particularly in the last 10 years, the phenomenon of repression, interviews, interrogation, of tactics used by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service is so prevalent. But I think what I'd like to stress today is one of the reasons why we don't have perhaps as vigorous a current of resistance, as vigorous a sort of a body of resistance, and not to say that does not exist, and Shireen Razak and Zuhair Kashmiri and others have written in this regard, but part of the reason why communities under attack are not as resistant and as vocal as they can be is because these communities are targeted for their marginality, because they live on the cusp, because they live in situations of precarity. And this is something that CSIS knows. It is something that Canada Border Services is aware of. When Clifton talked about these examples of human sources or providing bribes to informants within communities, these individuals are individuals who are at risk, individuals in precarious social and economic situations. So one of the reasons why these individuals may be co-opted is because precisely they live in such difficult circumstances. And so I'm going to address my comments to sort of three categories that jibe each with a number of cases that I've dealt with over the last 10 years, and again, resonate with some of the examples brought before with the panel this morning. The first area is going to deal with examples of repressive state measures by the Canadian state. And within that, I'm going to talk about security certificates briefly and enforcement measures by Canada Border Services working in tandem with CSIS. The second thing I want to talk about briefly is social engagement with the state. And here I want to talk about ways in which people are forced to interface with CSIS by virtue of applications for citizenship or by virtue of applications for job screening processes. So this is interface with the state. The third is sort of a broad kind of rubric which encompasses all, but I have specific subcategories dealing with what I would call the term guilt by association, which is very prevalent in terms of the CSIS paradigm or approach to Muslim and Arab communities. And I have various three subtopics I want to talk about. Persons of interest within Muslim and Arab communities. Secondly, organizations of interest. And finally, problems that arise from travel, travel overseas, and issues of opportunistic rendition and dual citizenship. So if I can start with the first category of repressive state measures, in this regard, the security certificate is really the showcase of everything oppressive, everything ideologically coercive of CSIS, of the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, in terms of how individuals, and in this case we're talking about the sort of five showcase examples which are in various stages, some of which are victories, such as the case of Adel Shekawi, such as the case of Hassan al-Mrai, others which continue to be struggles and challenges, such as the case of Mohammed Harkat. And the cases that are outstanding are, of course, the case of Mr. Majoub and Mr. Jabala. So in these cases, this is really the epitome of the examples of guilt by association. What we find here is a very rudimentary version of what we might refer to as a kind of threat matrix. In its sort of crudest sense, the security certificates are a diagram of individuals of interest, persons of interest, who are connected to other people who happen to be on the security radar of the Canadian state. And so really this is institutionalized in terms of a state process. It's brought on with secret evidence, something that's been challenged up to the Supreme Court on at least two occasions and continues to be under scrutiny. So it's an inherently unfair process where basically the very nature of the concern is that the individual has some tenuous link to someone else who appears to be a real target of concern. In some instances, that individual is not even a legitimate target of concern. But how does CSIS get to its objective? We know in the case of Mohammed Harkat that there were questionable tactics used in terms of unreliable human sources, something that caused a wide ripple effect within CSIS's protocol of using human sources, and in fact has disqualified human sources as being a source of information for the existing security certificate cases. But this in a sense does not deter the service from using human sources as a tactic, as Clifton talked about, as others have talked about, of gaining information on communities. Another important example is that of actually intercepting conversations between the detained individuals and their solicitors. This has happened repeatedly, historically, interceptions by CSIS. Recently, even in the file of Mr. Majoub, it has happened by the Canada Border Services Agency. So these kinds of systemic abuses are not anomalies. They are very much a part of the practice. The way in which secret and unfair trials are brought about is that they are propagated by abusive processes. And so much more can be said about security certificates, but I want to add another example, which is that of targeting by the Canada Border Service Agency, which works in tandem with CSIS, not simply in the vein of these five very prominent cases that we're no doubt aware about, but for persons of Muslim and Arab background who may be without status, who may be non-status from Algeria, who may be non-status Palestinians. And these individuals, because of their origins, because of their sort of perceived geopolitical linkages, they become targets of investigation. The very vivid example of this is what all of us are no doubt aware of with Project Thread in 2003 of 20 South Asian men being surreptitiously targeted, arrested in a lot of media fanfare and whisked out of the country. In a sense, something that happened with much less ado than the security certificate process, but something that shows that Muslim and Arab communities, particularly since 9/11, whether they may be with status or without status, are extremely vulnerable. One of the assumptions within this, which I think is important to raise, which stands for the security certificate process as well as for non-status persons, is an assumption that the use of false documentation, for example, is an indicator that someone may be a terrorist. Despite the fact that the 1995 UN Convention on Refugees explicitly acknowledges to the contrary that false documentation is used really as a method of necessity for people fleeing countries of persecution, routinely there is this assumption that people who use false documentation are doing so because of terrorist or violent linkages. I want to move now to social engagement with the state. And here I talked about applications for security screening. In the government context, that is with respect to enhanced reliability or secret clearance. As many of us may know who may work with the federal government, it is necessary that your screening be reviewed by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. So CSIS inserts itself in this way, and simultaneously maintains in other divisions of the institution its ongoing concern about national security, its sort of ideological orientation. And in this sense, there is a very fuzzy line, which I can say on the basis of concrete examples, that continues to be blurred. That where for a routine security screening, you may be drawn into an investigation with broader parameters that may touch on your family, or conversely, because of who your family is, who your associations are, that may become a basis for denial of your security screening. Similarly, with respect to citizenship applications, what I've seen time and again is that these applications may be delayed. You might find individuals for no apparent reason waiting 5 to 7 years because of simply it's unclear to them. It could be where they're from. It could be linkages of their family. It could be all sorts of reasons. But within the Muslim and Arab communities, this is seen repeatedly. And in this context, people become vulnerable. People become vulnerable because they need the security clearance to proceed to become Canadian citizens. And in this context, if they're approached by CSIS in respect of a national security investigation, they become vulnerable because they need to move to that next step. So that becomes another area of vulnerability which can and has been exploited by the service. The last area that I want to touch on with respect to guilt by association, obviously I'm just dealing with these quite superficially, it's a notion of persons of interest within the community. Clifton talked about that with respect to the Mohawk community. I can say in respect of active or ongoing or latent security investigations that I've seen in Ottawa over the last 10 years, that we constantly see waves of CSIS talking to individuals. I've attended at dozens of interviews or interrogations where individuals are forced to answer the questions of the service in a manner which is articulated as being optional. You know, you don't have to answer these questions, But if you don't, you'll continue to be a person of interest. We may talk to your friends. We may talk to others. We may continue our questions in the community. Our interest will not cease. Yet, as was also mentioned by, earlier, that if you do talk, there becomes an added interest to continue that conversation and perhaps to dwell on speculation or to further the ambit of guilt by association. So these networks continue not only in respect of a person being a person of interest because they may actually know someone, but potentially even that a person may be simply connected within the community. They might have a religious knowledge. They may be active in the mosque. They may be a person of authority within the community. In this regard, they are simply approached because of their position. That you know something, and you should decide to speak to us, because if you don't, something egregious may happen to your community, and that onus therefore rests on you as the individual within this community to come forward to tell us what you know. So it's a reverse onus upon the person to come forward and share their information. Organizations of interest, and I just have 2 points left here. Post 9/11, there has been sort of a focus on charities and humanitarian intervention, whether it's in the Middle East or other countries of large Muslim populations. These immediately become suspect because of the geopolitical region within which the organizations are active. It could be about individuals who have expressed an interest with that organization. It could be about the board of directors, or it could be about, not even in a Canadian context, it could be about an American concern about how the perception is of that Canadian-based organization when that organization itself is a legitimate, lawful, registered charitable organization in the state of Canada. So there are all sorts of ways in which, insidiously, organizations may be tacked, may be denied charitable status, and may become the target of a national security investigation. Finally, with respect to the question of opportunistic rendition and travel overseas, the unfortunate circumstance is that many Muslims and Arabs, in traveling overseas to meet their family and being in other countries, despite the fact that they have Canadian citizens, are used and exploited for their dual nationality, rendered or forced to go back to their country of origin so they can be dealt with by sister or partner agencies, detained, as was the case with Abu Sufyan of Al-Razik, but certainly not the only case. We know from other cases, such as the case of Meher Arar, such as the case of Mr. Al-Malki, and other cases of that nature, that these are not anomalies. The opportunistic process of following individuals, not simply with foreign intelligence agencies, but also having CSIS go overseas and pursue individuals in other countries to advance their agenda, has become a sort of a systemic part of investigation. So in this sense, the guilt by association follows the individual, not only within the confines of Canada and the Canadian state, but it also follows people globally and internationally. So within all of this, I think that there needs to be a concerted discussion about how we break this perception of guilt by association. And with respect to what the previous speakers have said about the ideological, practical, and other bases of CSIS, we need to attack that at its foundation in terms of how guilt by association is used in terms of this ongoing ideological campaign against various communities, and the Muslim and Arab communities in Canada are a prime example of this. Thank you.
Merci Gavard. Alors, l'atelier aujourd'hui, ben, le panel ce matin sera suivi par un atelier cet après-midi qui aura lieu à 15h30. Le but de l'atelier, de le panel ce matin, encore une fois, c'est d'exposer les origines du SCRS ainsi que les façons dont cette agence opère. Et puis, cet après-midi, lors de l'atelier, le but, c'est de commencer à tisser des liens et élaborer des stratégies pour faire face à cette agence. La discussion continuera cet après-midi, mais pour le moment, on ouvre le plancher pour des questions qui seront posées aux panélistes.